awesome to welcome CIA Bella Vista College Prep head coach Brandon Rosenthal to the Basketball Podcast. Rosenthal brings a wealth of experience to his coaching career, encompassing 6 years of professional experience, 9 years at the collegiate level, and 1 year in high school. In his inaugural year as head coach at CIA Bella Vista College Prep, Rosenthal revitalized the basketball program, transforming it into a championship contender, and was named the 2024-25 EYBL Scholastic Coach of the Year. During the 2024-25 season, Bella Vista achieved a 24 overall regular season record. The team reached rankings as high as number 2 by Max Preps, number 4 by Slam, and number 5 by ESPN. Notably, the team secured the most top 10 wins and the most top 25 wins of any team in the nation, and played what was considered the toughest schedule in the country. The program received an invitation to the 2025 Chipotle Nationals. Rosenthal's extensive assistant coaching experience includes roles at various levels, including an assistant coach for the Santa Cruz Warriors, an assistant coach, director of scouting and player development at Arizona State University, a video and player development coordinator for the Phoenix Suns, an assistant coach for the Northern Arizona Suns, a video assistant for the Houston Rockets, and an interim assistant coach, director of basketball operations at Santa Clara University. Hey, coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams, get started now. Basketball Immersion Group membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast. Brandon, welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Chris, thanks for having me on today. Appreciate it.
Grateful to have you here and excited to talk to you and share a lot of our conversations that we have offline with people online, and that's perfect. EYBL Scholastic Coach of the Year. And when I look through your resume, and obviously I've known you for a long time, man, just the diversity of experience. It's pretty incredible all the different experiences you've had at all the different levels.
I've been really fortunate. I think early in my career, I didn't necessarily look at it that way. When I got into the NBA, I worked for a lot of different head coaches in a short period of time. And there's a part of you at some points that feels maybe a little guilty that things didn't work out from one staff to the next staff and for one head coach and so forth. But those were all really special learning experiences, obviously, to have worked for as many people as I have. And I'm really grateful for the opportunities that I've had so far.
What were some of the takeaways from those experiences for you personally?
Oh, I think the first thing is just that there's a lot of different ways to be successful in basketball, that not just one way is the only way. I've worked for head coaches that I feel like all ends of the spectrum, whether it's style of play, whether it's leadership. I've gotten to a place where sometimes realistically that maybe as a head coach, it's about adapting and trying to find the best way to really help your team. And recognizing too, especially when you're an assistant coach, who your boss is and what they value, what's important to them, what they're emphasizing, and then where can you fit? Where can you help them be successful? A lot of different things there for sure.
And talk to us about the adaptability part of it. For you personally, one of the strengths of these experiences is that it's made you incredibly adaptable as a coach.
When I first got into the NBA, my first year with the Houston Rockets, Chris Finch was our offensive coordinator, obviously the head coach of the Minnesota Timberwolves right now. J.B. Bickerstaff was our defensive coordinator, Detroit Pistons head coach now. I had incredible examples of what an assistant coach looked like in the NBA. And they were encyclopedias of basketball. It was like you could throw a million different options up on a whiteboard on how we guard a pick and roll or how we guard a dribble handoff or how we attack opponent's defense. And they were so good at cutting everything down and trimming it right to what was going to be best for the staff to be able to go out and execute and what was going to be best for the players. And going through that process gave me this idea of like, all right, I have to learn to be adaptable to our personnel, be adaptable, again, to the coaches I'm working with. We all have different strengths. We all have different weaknesses, being able to play off of one another, and ultimately being the best assistant coach that I can be for the head coach. And sometimes that means giving more of my opinion. Sometimes that means giving less of my opinion. It just depended on what was needed.
It sounds like a bit of a balancing act. And of course, just be ready and be able to contribute and be able to proactively contribute, which I know in talking to you in the past is such an important part of being a good assistant, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The thing too, and I always tell this to people, if you get the opportunity to maybe coach at the Division III level, Division II level, obviously high school, like staff sizes are small. You get into Division I, you get into the NBA, you start seeing staff sizes of 25 coaches. And so there's benefit in that. You get to see, obviously, stuff done at an extremely high level where coaches are really specialized in one specific area and things are done at such a professional level that it's perfection is almost expected. Whereas at some of these lower levels, it's meat and potatoes only and really focus in on what's most important and so forth. And with that, you adapt to sometimes taking on a bigger role and wearing a lot of different hats. And then other times, hey, when it's my turn, I need to shine. I need to be great. And then other times I just need to support, but really ultimately stay in my lane.
Well, we've mentioned your transition from NBA, NCAA, and a high-level high school basketball. So maybe focus on the high-level high school basketball experience that you just had this past season. Talk to us about some of the things from the NBA or the NCAA that helped you in this experience.
Yeah, man, what a fun year we had. Obviously, Chris got to see you a couple times on the road and so forth. But coming in, I had no idea what to expect. Wanted the opportunity to be a head coach. Had thought that maybe my first opportunity of being a head coach was something that I'd have to go overseas to do. So this was a unique opportunity that presented itself being back in Phoenix. I'm from Phoenix. My wife and I and our daughter, we're going on 10 years out here. So there have been a couple other stops in between, but 10 years total. And so it was a unique opportunity. I knew we were going to be playing the best teams in high school basketball. So I knew the competition level was going to be really good, but still had no idea what to expect. Didn't know what to expect internally. Didn't know what to expect in terms of competition and the preparation piece behind it. If we were going to be any good, it really took me until maybe late December, early January to look around and be like, you know what, we got a chance to be pretty special this year, do something cool. And I went into it initially with, and again, expectations were really low too. The leadership group after I'd been hired had just told me, hey, this is probably going to be a 2 or 3 year process for us to be successful. Be patient with it, but also use this opportunity to have the platform to be creative and try some different things. So I had some ideas in mind and we jumped right into it. And really started with, you know, wanting to emphasize certain things offensively and defensively that I was curious if it would translate from the higher levels, from the NBA or from college, and trying to figure out, again, what fits, what works, what doesn't work. And ultimately, as the season progressed, started realizing like what a lot of what we were doing at the professional level or high level Division I college basketball, we can do at this level. And had a lot of fun going through that process, a lot of growing pains, a lot of rinse and repeat. A lot of times where I had to remind myself to slow down, but that's what a great coaching staff is for. And they definitely did an awesome job of checking me and helping me stay on task and paying attention to what was most important. But overall, an incredible experience and really enjoyed it.
Well, offensively, I know you played conceptual basketball for the most part. Obviously, you had some plays for players, but mostly conceptual. And that was a big plan. And that's a big mandate, really, for EYBL in general, is to be able to get players to be more conceptual, increased basketball IQ and all that. And you're a great guy to be able to do that because that's what you've experienced at different levels of basketball. So maybe first talk to us about installing offense. And I know that you said you taught offense before defense. So maybe a reason behind that and then go into a little bit of the offensive install.
Yeah, it's funny. I always have thought offense is more difficult to teach than defense. There's a lot of reasons behind that. But I think with defense, for example, you give principles of no middle, no paint, switch everything, finish the play. Like that gives you a foundation right there, Chris, to play with. If we said that before we were about to go play a pickup game at the YMCA, we'd have a little bit of direction in terms of what we were doing defensively. So that was like just our foundation point defensively. So offensively, it allowed me to spend more time and our staff spend more time on getting the guys aligned. I also wanted guys to feel good about their games and confident. We had a preseason game earlier in the year, and we ended up winning the game, actually won the game by quite a bit, but there was a guard from the other team that destroyed us pretty good. So after the game, I asked all the guys and I said, we had one of the tallest teams in high school basketball this year. And I asked the guys, how many of you at some point in your high school career have played center? And of the nine players on our team, five of them raised their hand. So we had five centers on our team. Some high school teams are lucky if they have one guy that can play center for them. We had five. And the trick was realistically down the road, maybe only two of them will end up playing center in college. And those two may even move over to the four spot at some point. And so for the other guys, it was about developing their perimeter skills, developing their confidence out on the perimeter, teaching them offensive patterns so that they could get comfortable with one another, and really ultimately trusting each other. And we had such good guards and talented guards that could score. I really wanted to make sure that the basketball moved so everybody felt involved with the offense. A lot of times, obviously, when you have spacing, whether it's four around one, five around, five out, you end up in situations where, and especially when you're teaching conceptual basketball, where the ball doesn't move. And I wanted to make sure we had established that and guys had purpose and knew exactly what they were doing offensively. And so it was an opportunity for us to spend more time on that. Meanwhile, defensively, as you're guarding all of that, you start recognizing problems, right? If your team has good competitive spirit, you're not going to want to get scored on all the time. And so guys, defenders, they start seeing different actions. What worked, what didn't work. And you can start coaching through those different situations. And so what was awesome to see is whether, let's say it was just low corner split action and guys got scored on real quickly, real easily, there'd be a little bit of frustration, but there'd be good conversation. And obviously better for them to figure it out on their own a little bit at first. And then if they did get a stop and they did guard it properly, now they're the ones figuring that out. And then as a coach, I can go back through and I can slowly clean it up and I can give, whether it's some technical information or tactical feedback to just really help them be better at what they're doing defensively, help them grow. And then from there, you keep adding and layering your defense. Now we're going to pressure the basketball. So now we're starting to establish a pickup point. We're not going to come off corners. Now, because we're sending the ball baseline, now we can work on our rotations on the weak side. So it slowly starts building. And I think, again, as long as your competitive spirit is there, as long as your purpose is there, it just made it easier to teach defense that way over the course of the season and actually spend a little bit less defense, because if you're doing everything 3-on-3, 4-on-4, 5-on-5, you're working on defense at the same exact time. So that was a little bit of the background in terms of how we were teaching things and how we're implementing stuff this year.
Well, I love that. I love you sharing that with us. The value is what you said, is that it's two-way coaching. Offense and defense are connected. And even if you're emphasizing one, you're still developing the other at the same time and those different things that go with it. But it also strikes me as well how much easier it is to, as you said, get a little more structured because your players have experienced all these different situations. So if you need to structure the offense or the defense more, they're already conceptually better off so they can do that.
Again, Chris, I didn't know what needed to be taught necessarily, right? I knew what I want our finished product to look like. What was so unique about our group, and people will ask you, what was with the turnaround this year? Why were you guys so successful? A lot of the ingredients for success were already in place. Like our guys, a normal school day, we typically practice from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. And the kids at lunchtime automatically find themselves back in the gym. And then right after school, they're back in the gym. And then they go out and work out. And I was the guy, unfortunately, throughout the year that kept telling the guys to rest and relax and stay off their feet and stay out of the gym. In terms of the love and passion for the game, and sometimes you coach a team and you're around a group and you're almost begging them to get in the gym. We were the complete opposite end of the spectrum with that. So we had little things like that that were already established, that were part of our blueprint in our DNA. Then realistically, as the season progressed, like I started realizing my job is to really just give them direction, give them purpose, give them an identity in terms of how we're going to play offensively and defensively. And as the year went forward, I was able to start recognizing, like, this is what our team ultimately needs to be successful, whether that's my coaching style in game, whether that's how we're going about practices. I thought our guys during the course of the year started to really recognize in-game situations. We had a lot of guys that just they'd show up and just play, right? And there's beauty in that. And that's what you want. You want guys that just play, but every day was almost like it was gym class. You weren't really paying attention to the score. You were out there just having fun. So that piece of it, we checked that box. And so it was good for us to go through that process of how to manage the clock, how to get certain shots when certain guys were going. So our conversations turned much more purposeful about basketball, offensively, defensively, game management wise. And that made me a better coach. And it made me more prepared in terms of how I could really help the guys through the year. Because there are a lot of times through, whether it be in practice or being games, I try to take a big step back and just evaluate and try to figure out, okay, where am I needed? What do these guys need? And like I said, it took some time, probably took 4 or 5 games of the year, and then a lot of practices too.
Part I want to highlight, because I know my NBA colleagues will appreciate you saying this, because this is one of the hardest things dealing with elite players, is to actually get them rest and recovery. It's not just the basketball. It's not just the cognitive effort or the physical effort in basketball. It's all the other noise that they deal with on a daily basis. Parents, agents, social media, teammates, opponents, all these different things. So it's great that you were finding that way to be able to say, hey, listen, you don't need more. In a way, you need less and more purposeful.
Right. Player development, I think, is it's holistic and everything connects together. Your sleep, your diet, who you surround yourself with, what your preparation is, all of that connects together. And I was able to figure out relatively quickly again what our strengths were, just where our potential was to ultimately get better. And that was what we spent a lot of time, and rest was a big one for sure.
Yeah, I love hearing that. And talk to us a little bit about evolving the system throughout the season. You referenced that a little bit, but talk to us deeper. What went into that in your mind that you decided they're ready for something, or we can change something, or we can add something, or in some cases, subtract something?
Yeah, the thing I knew about conceptual basketball is you're going to go through highs and lows of the season. Teams are going to get better. They're scouting you. They're going to start to recognize your strengths and weaknesses. And so you can go through stretches where your offense just doesn't look good. You can go through stretches where you're turning the ball over a lot. You can go through stretches where you're not making shots that normally you hit. So that was one phase that I knew I was going to have to go through in terms of convincing our staff and convincing our program's leadership to be patient with. And for me to also be patient, just based off of our personnel, that there were going to be some ugly offensive games. But I felt like if our defensive was sound and our preparation was really good, there were a lot of ways for us to win basketball games. And so it didn't matter if our offense was really good or not. And we just needed to make sure we kept growing from that. And then we got to a stretch in the middle of the season. And usually that's when you see it. Beginning of the year, I think if you're in the best, if you're conditioned, if you are competitive, if you've got the talent, you're going to win games out of the gate. But like I referenced with, we played Columbus, and that game was so valuable for us because they won, obviously won the national championship this year, some absolute stud players, great coaching staff, very prepared, organized with what they were doing. And it was great for us because you could see the talent that we had. We were making plays. We were winning with 4 minutes to go in the game. But that fourth quarter in terms of our execution, and we weren't ready to get the right guy's shots. We weren't ready to little stuff like understanding if you foul early at the beginning of the fourth quarter, you're gonna put the team on the free throw line down the stretch, and against a really good team, you don't want to do that. Us learning how to hunt fouls and be able to flip that. So there were just a lot of little teaching points that we needed to go through. And we went through that in that game, especially against Columbus. Then we ended up winning another 11 or 12 games in a row. And then we run into Montverde. And Montverde, obviously, everybody knows about their success. And we didn't play a very good game overall. I thought emotionally we were absolutely exhausted. And it was, I think, our third weekend in a row of playing and our second trip back to the Midwest. And we'd gone, I think we went to East Coast, Midwest, back to the Midwest. And I can tell we were hitting a wall. And then obviously in that game, we were paying a little bit more attention to what was on the front of the jersey playing against a team like Montverde, and the game was on ESPN. That's, you talk about player development. Part of player development is getting used to playing in front of a lot of people, a lot of coaches, not getting distracted by the cameras and the media piece of it all and the business side of basketball. And in that game, Montverde, I would have thought was probably the best defensive team we played all year. And they did a terrific job of taking away a lot of our strengths and the things we like to do offensively. And so it was a good learning lesson for us that there were certain things, whether it be our pace into different actions or some of our different triggers and getting into them faster, or whether it was some of the sets that we want to get into, being able to execute them better, not getting pushed off our spots, going to the next action if the first action fails. And so that was a good learning opportunity for us. As much as we wanted to win that game, it was good for us to go through that process. And so we really cleaned up our offense from that point on. And then from there, you're continuing to add little things. So teams started pressuring us up a lot higher. What you're seeing in the NBA in playoffs right now, where teams have a high pickup point a lot of times over into the backcourt. So we started doing a lot of guard-to-guard step-ups and allowing our guards to get downhill. So there was just a lot of little things that we added throughout the year because of the adjustments teams were obviously making.
Well, it speaks to adaptability, but also you can't put it all in at once. And sometimes you don't know what you need to do. And you reference figure it out before. And obviously, that's one of the biggest parts of coaching in general, is your players will help you determine, and your opponent will help you determine a little bit of what you need to do better. And both of that's obviously on display. I'm curious. I know you dealt with the agent piece, you dealt with the administration piece, you dealt with the noise piece, but let's focus more on the players, who by and large probably came from a little bit more traditional set type of basketball than conceptual basketball. You talk more about how your players adapted to the conceptual offense and then how you coach them conceptually, including how you introduce the different topics.
I took a whole part whole approach. I think conceptual basketball is fun for the guys as long as, again, the basketball is moving and everybody feels involved. One thing I tried to do, especially because of the fact that we were so big and we weren't necessarily as skilled out on the perimeter, just with our, again, with our personnel, is I really introduced cutting into our offense. So it gave guys more of a role instead of getting stuck in the corner. So we call the concept follow the help. Anytime you have a slot drive, you have a baseline cut. Anytime you have a baseline drive, you have a slot cut. Worked a lot on different ways to relocate the five man if we were four around one. And so conceptually, I think you have to start with how you're playing in transition and get into your different, how you're going to space the floor. I'm a big component or proponent on random basketball is beautiful. Like I want the more random the game is, I think the more beautiful it is. An ideal world, you know, and a lot of people would comment on this. I'm good to just stand at half court and be a fan of the guys and watch how they're making plays and playing off of one another and taking what the defense gives them. And so you talk about, again, transition. Biggest thing that we emphasized was obviously running the floor, throwing the ball ahead. We want to throw the ball ahead because it flattens out the defense. And that way, if you don't have an early strike, you can throw the ball back. And the defense has been flattened out. It's really difficult to get into ball screen coverage. So you can run right into a drag. And then here's your advantage. Try to keep your advantage and play off of one another. And then if you get stuck in the half court, you have different triggers. We called our go screen, our guard-to-guard action, Omahas. And so you'd hear me from the bench sometimes yelling Omaha, which just meant go create action, go create an advantage. And it was usually just whether it's the slot-to-slot guard pass or corner throwing it back to the guy in the slot and chasing after it. And if teams were switching it, a lot of times we emphasize rolling, see if we could get the switch and get a smaller defender on some of our bigger wings and forwards. If it was a team that would stay with their man, we'd end up setting the screen. And that was part of the scouting process. And again, talk about evolving your offense. And this is going to sound a little Belichick-ish. You have a system, right? You want to establish your system. And then the fun thing is you start playing better competition and play competition that makes adjustments and makes you better. And so then you have to make an adjustment. And so we'd always have two or three things that we'd usually emphasize on both sides of the floor that we would need to do. And a lot of times it would just be, hey, this is what we're going to do in terms of setting our ball screens, whether we want you setting them or slipping. Maybe we want you twisting ball screens this game or flipping your screen. And then sometimes a lot of emphasis was what we did on the weak side because we cut so much. I really wanted our guys to hold space. There were games where it made sense to exchange. And so now the guys, as we're progressing through the season, those are some of our conversations. And sometimes if you don't bring it up in the scout or in a walkthrough, the guys will ask you that type of question. And so that's what also really generates good basketball conversation and really helps evolve your team. And if you're scouting us, you didn't know necessarily whether we were holding our space or we were exchanging on the weak side or when we were cutting and when we weren't cutting because of all of that too. So there was a lot of purpose behind that. But going back to your initial question, Chris, obviously then in the half court, we put a big premium on attacking the paint. We were not a very good shooting team. And so we needed to generate really good catch and shoot opportunities. And I know everybody has the debate about mid-range shots and shot spectrum and so forth. I spent more time talking about what's a great shot for us as a team. And I really wanted the guys to be confident that when they attack the paint, they can make a good decision with the basketball, whether that was finishing or whether that was kicking the ball out. And again, that's how you start building your offensive patterns is let's create different advantages, whether it's again out of split action, whether it's out of a ball screen, we get you downhill, we get you into the paint, you make the right paint decision. And then it's either a catch and shoot, it's a one more, it's a follow the help. And that's how we play. And a lot of times people talk about, okay, are you a sets team? Are you a single side tag zoom team? To me, we're a blender team. And that was our offense. Obviously, we had plays. When Igor took over with the Phoenix Suns, he talked about how important it is to have motion and be able to just play out of different concepts and play off of each other. And that's where he came up with the name Blender Basketball. And but he also recognized, though, you get into the playoffs and the game really slows down, you need sets. And when teams are really keying in on your best players, how are you going to get them basketball? And so that was then where we started really implementing a couple more sets and different things. And then at that point, I was much more comfortable with what worked at the high school level. The challenge sometimes at the high school level is defenses don't guard certain actions the way that you think they should or they will. And sometimes the more basic actions end up working out a lot better than sometimes some of your more complex or layered offensive sets. So that was kind of how we built our offense this year.
Well, it sounded like you had a lot of fun to be able to, again, go into so many ideas that have stuck with you for so long in your coaching career and get a chance to play around as a coach as well and figure it out on the fly, which is always a great learning experience.
Hey, coach, a brief timeout from the podcast to bring you the Analytics Minute, sponsored by Hoopsalytics. How do you decide who your biggest impact players are? Traditional stats don't tell the whole story, which is why high-level pro and college teams rely on analytic systems like Hoopsalytics to make data-driven lineup decisions. Examining team stats when a player is on the floor tells a more compelling story. For example, you can use net points per possession to determine your best two-way players, as well as your offensive and defensive stars, or use the team rebounding percentage for each player to see who has the biggest impact on rebounding. The results may surprise you. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Discover how Hoopsalytics can help you make better data-driven coaching decisions. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball. That's hoopsalytics.com/ball today to learn more and start analyzing your games for free.
You also played a lot of players, and you had to balance a lot of playing time for some really good players. And I know that's common for a lot of coaches as well. Can you talk about how you manage that?
The business of basketball, and I think that's what you're seeing become so much more prevalent at the high school level. We're starting to deal with it at the college level, especially if you're at a high major school and you've got potential draft guys on your roster. I think now in high school, most high school players that are top 100 kids, maybe top 200 kids, they have agents. They have representation. Their ranking matters. Your job at the high school level is, quite frankly, take away the human element in terms of looking after them and helping them as people, but your next most important responsibility is getting them off to college. And it's tough to sell to a college coach, the ninth man on our team who's averaging 9 minutes a game and 4 points is a Division I player. But the beauty of EYBL Scholastic, in a lot of ways, that's how talented some of these rosters are. You have guys at the end of their roster, at the end of your roster, that are their Division I players and potentially future Power Four players as they transfer and move up. And so you have to be very self-aware. You have to be compassionate about the fact that there are a lot of other important moving parts in the background. And so I've always, the unique thing with Bella Vista, we had seven teams. We're an academy. Our really one through four has Division I players in our program. We had 25 student athletes between our boys and girls teams get Division I offers, which is again so rare. And we had players on our second team and third team that probably would have helped our EYBL team be a lot better if we were able to have all those kids on our team. But the reality of it is, you don't want to stockpile at one position for that reason, for the future of college. And you want guys to have opportunity and continue to grow and develop. I think these are really important years for players' development. So as much as we want to keep winning at the forefront, the development piece and the human piece of it is much more important. And so with nine players, I always knew after every single game was probably going to have two players that were a little bit frustrated with their playing time. And that's where, again, and it might not even be because they didn't play. It might have been because there was a college coach that was there to see them. And so those conversations, I think the whether it's individual conversations, whether it's collective group conversations, that was maybe as important of a part of my job as anything this year. And understanding that everybody on the team was sacrificing and recognizing too, you go to these tournaments in EYBL, you're playing a lot of times 3 games in 3 days. And so having the depth can be a real benefit. And helping guys understand that from one game to the next game, their role could change a little bit. Their minutes could significantly change. And that was the beauty for me, is I was able to, and our staff, we were able to adjust our lineups and adjust some of our rotations based off of who we were playing against. And then a lot of times people would ask me, all right, how are you guys going to look today? And I tell you, I'll be able to know after the first 5 minutes of our game, because I'll know what role I need to play as the head coach. And sometimes it's a little bit of a survival. You got to just figure out a way to get through the game and figure out how to just win the game. And then other games, again, you can take a big step back and let the players navigate the game and then provide support where it's needed. But identifying the fact that, again, they all have different pressures. The ranking piece now is really important. A lot of times what you're ranked impacts what your NIL status looks like coming out of high school and where you start once you get into that ecosystem of college basketball. Just, again, big picture, you see everybody, Division II players transferring up to Division I, low major Division I players transferring up to P4 schools. It's a big part of the starting point for you. And so, again, we spent a lot of time in those conversations and addressing that. And then my biggest thing, and this was maybe a little bit on the selfish side, but you know, I really wanted the guys to understand how to play from a basketball standpoint. I wanted you to understand how to play with the other four players on the floor, both offensively and defensively. So it didn't matter where you went off to college. You'd be able to exist and you'd be able to figure it out. And a lot of times what happens when you get to the NBA, and you see this a lot in the G League, they've always been the best player on their team. They were the star player in high school. They always had the ball in their hands. They go to college, same exact situation. And then once they get to the NBA, it's the first time a player's ever come off the bench before. It's the first time a player's had a DNP. And that's why I always go back to the holistic piece of it. Your development and the time and attention that you give to a player can be very different based on what role they play within the team. And so some of that I thought made for healthy conversation and sharing with guys like, hey, this is good for you that you're not starting this game. This is good for you that you're learning how to navigate a game by only getting 9-10 minutes of playing time. Probably won't happen again for you, but that's a learning experience that the next time you're in that situation, you're going to know how to handle it and how to navigate it.
You've circled around this a little bit, but to talk to us a bit about coach accountability versus player accountability. And I think coaches probably picked up on the first 5 minutes of a game. Maybe go a little deeper in terms of that initially and saying, okay, a mentor of mine told me a long time ago, coach opposite your team. What your team's doing is you're coaching opposite them a little bit, because if they're fired up, you don't need to be fired up.
Correct. That's exactly how I approach every game. The fun thing for us in talking about an academy with Bella Vista, our practices sometimes were more competitive than our games. The guys really knew each other. Again, our quote second team had the number 17 ranked center in the country, and he's going to Georgia Tech, and had another player who's going to Boise State. The starting point guard of that team was the Canadian national team's starting point guard for U17. So team was absolutely low. So to get to practice against those guys every single day. And so then I got to use practice to figure out where some of our strengths and weaknesses were. And so there were a lot of times where, as a coach, you might blow the whistle and you might say, hey, we're gonna get on the sideline and run for that. Or you might say, and what worked out more beneficially for myself, especially, was to watch how we navigated those different situations. So if we weren't playing really well, how could we get ourselves out of it? And anything else, you have different standards for yourself. There's a standard that you don't want to drop below in terms of maybe poor basketball play or selfishness or frustration. And a lot of times for me, kind of give this example, a lot of times what players do, the player has the basketball, he takes a shot and he has an open teammate. And the ball goes back down to the other side of the floor, and the teammate that was open ends up having a breakdown defensively in coverage and ends up hurting the guy that took the shot, the possession before that. And then the two of them come to the bench and they're arguing with each other, and both are wrong in what they did. And then both are very much right in acknowledging each other's problems. And so sometimes as a coach, you have to be the one that pulls all of that together and gives that explanation to them in layman terms. And so for me, it was beneficial to just be able to step back and watch and evaluate. I'd rather have our team be able to navigate different situations through a game where I don't have to use timeouts. I tried to always save my timeouts for the end of the game, because whether it was trying to just get the ball in, if we were up and the other team was fouling, or if I needed timeouts to drop a play, I wanted that flexibility to always have those timeouts in hand. And so I really, at different times, tested our team, especially using practice as a way to figure out, okay, who are the guys that I know if it's a little chaotic out there that I can get in there to settle things? Who are the guys I need to look towards if things are going a little bit sideways, that they can bring us back? And if that person's a little bit sideways, then I know, hey, we've got a problem on our hands and I probably need to call timeout, or I need to address some things at halftime in the locker room. The fun games for us were when, again, the energy was really high and the enthusiasm was there, and the guys were seeing the game, and they'd come into a huddle and they're talking strategy. I don't even need to get in the middle of it, but they're the engagement with each other. And that's, quite frankly, that's how we talked a lot about roles and responsibilities within the team, is like more so what does the team need from you for us to be successful? And that was how we addressed each other, and that was how we held each other to a certain standard throughout the year too.
Love that. I love that the depth of that understanding of what you could do and what you tried to do and everything that came from it. And of course, one of the things that you manage so well is that while you're trying to develop players, which is ultimately the goal, even though nobody thinks that's the goal is to win, right? Unfortunately, you can't get around that. At UIBL Scholastic, you got to win. So you balance that so well, developing players and still succeeding and winning. So talk to us about managing that.
Yeah, the G League, I think the NBA and G League experience definitely helped me in that space. It's funny because I have a memory too of one of my experiences in the G League, our GM coming to us and saying, listen, every all hands on deck, just focus in on development. Don't worry about winning. Don't even worry about scouting reports. But learning how to win is part of development. Learning how to understand a scouting report is part of development. Needless to say, that wasn't the direction we went. But I just think in terms of developing guys, it's a process, right? And so if you're doing a great job developing your players, you're doing a great job developing your teams, the end product should ultimately be winning. For me, in addressing a high school game, one of the big adjustments I had to make was how quickly the game goes by. It's a 32-minute game in most cases. It's a fast game. It ends blink of an eye, and there's not a lot of possessions in the game. A lot of times when you go into the fourth quarter, if you are losing, there's a big disadvantage. It can be really difficult to come back in the fourth quarter, and especially if you're playing against a team that really manages the clock well. And I always felt it was a race to get to the last 4 minutes of the game, and then you try to figure out how to win the game based on what the situation is. But you want to put yourself in the best position possible to try to be in the power position with the last 4 minutes. And so navigating that whole situation with the development piece and the winning piece, you keep the focus in on the process part of it. And I think if you, and this is again coaching high level players, if you're investing in them individually, which they're used to, whether it's from an agent, whether it's from a family member, whether it's from a skill development coach that they're dealing with off the court, guys are really used to individual development. One of the challenges we had this year is we did have such a small staff. And one of the things I missed maybe the most this year, when you're in the NBA and you're responsible for a player's development, you get to really focus in on 1% of their game. Like, how do we improve just this one aspect? And you get to just go one layer by layer and get deeper in terms of trying to help that player. In high school basketball, and again, being the head coach, like there's three of us realistically. And I had to keep the vision of the big picture and what we were trying to accomplish, as opposed to sometimes getting into the nitty gritty. But I recognized too that whether it was a big win or a big loss, a lot of times that's when I did my individual film sessions with guys and tried to really have a good pulse of the team in terms of when they needed my attention and when just in terms of our assistants' attention was good enough. I know I'm rambling on a little bit here, Chris, but there's a lot of different ways to approach that.
Love it. I feel like you're digesting the whole experience in front of us, which is awesome
Yeah,
for
sorry,
all of us
yes.
to go through. To be truthful, again, it's just awesome. I'm so grateful you got this experience. And you mentioned there something about the 1%, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, especially now coaching this kind of high level scholastic level, because I just feel like too many coaches get muddied in the water with thinking about a micro skill and improving someone like a 1%, when really the biggest impact at the development level is that macro picture, right? Being able to provide a conceptual understanding of, okay, I have this skill. Now, where do I apply it and where do I use it?
Again, the beauty of the NBA is that you have so many specialists. And so, as long as an organization, you've knocked down all those silos and everybody's working together, as the basketball coach, you do probably get to focus in on that 1%, but you have to have a bigger understanding of how the other pieces are impacting that 1%. At this level, I found myself trying to just, in some ways, prevent bad habits. So, if I saw something, I didn't necessarily correct it the very first time, but by the second or third time, I would correct it. And then, whether it was a specific skill or something like that, we wanted to have rocks in terms of skills that would translate into our season and help a player navigate a season and obviously keep their confidence up. To me, the biggest thing, whether it's shooting, whether it's playing in the game, like we want you to be at your very best when the lights are on, and we want your confidence to be through the roof. And so I never wanted to take away a player's confidence because of how we were approaching their development or where we were at in our season and being so focused in on winning. And so that when you talk about that narrowing in on that 1%, sometimes that was focusing on things that would help build their confidence and find ways to be able to stay on the floor or find ways to make a bigger impact on winning. I know when I probably got the most excited during a game is when somebody that you're trying to convince that they were better at attacking a closeout instead of just catching and shooting every single time. And so when you get that straight line physical drive and finish at the basket, those were small victories, right? Those were wins within the game that you could celebrate, you could show on film, you could acknowledge with them. And that's all part of development too.
Were you able to? I know that was a plan for you. Were you able to, I guess, build and develop your identity while still winning?
Yes. And I won't know how much of this was luck and so forth, but like I talked about, I think at the beginning of the year, I wanted to make sure we were the most well-conditioned team. And you don't know how tough you are, but try to be the toughest team. And I thought that stole us some games early. Thought we were prepared. I thought the energy was really there. I thought when the lights were on, the guys played really hard. Part of the problem for us is we probably peaked in late December, early January. Because expectations were so low and we didn't think we were going to play in a postseason, and based on how the high school season goes and when nationals are, we probably started our year maybe a full month, if not 6 weeks too early. And so thankfully, and give a lot of credit to our staff and our strength coach and our skill coaches, we didn't have any catastrophic injuries. We stayed healthy throughout most of the year. But as we got towards the end of the year, we got a little bit banged up and so forth. And I think, again, it was just because we started everything too soon. But yeah, I think the winning piece was really important just to build trust with the players. And one of the unique things about this level is for a lot of players and their experiences, it's the people that train them, the people that coach them in a lot of ways, they're the people they live with. They're the people they travel with all the time. You have a little bit of a different relationship with the kids. And so establishing that coach-player relationship and building that trust, you have to find kind of unique ways to do it, because what they're so used to is they're used to being coached by their parent or, again, their AU coach that, again, is around them 24/7 and play and wears a lot of different hats. And so for me, going to play Topgolf wasn't going to just create trust. Wasn't going to establish a belief in what we were doing. So the winning was a big piece of that. Having a big win over Prolific to start the year right after they had just knocked off Columbus. I think you were at that game. I thought that game it created in terms of how we were playing, and I thought then I had their attention. And then when we lost to Columbus, it was the first time that I saw a little bit of doubt. Maybe we're not good enough. And getting to go through trying to reel the team back in and for them to see, I almost never do this. I don't really philosophically believe it, but that was the one game that we actually ended up watching the entire game through and through because I wanted them to see that we had the talent to play with what people said was the number one team in the country. But to see how far we needed to go in terms of our execution and reading the game and thinking the game and so forth. And then as that happens, you start layering things as the competition gets a little bit better and teams start making adjustments to you. And again, one thing talking about addressing the fact that it's funny with all these kids having agents, your relationship with parents changed too. And the parents were great this year. Usually when I spoke to a parent, it was all super positive and optimistic and grateful for what we were doing as a staff with the kids. But when the agent calls you and says, "Hey, can we get this player a little bit more playing time, a few more shots?" And I was used to that at the professional level. Now, obviously, that goes more so through your general manager. But, okay, they're putting out some fires on your behalf and you need to work with them. That also creates a little bit of an identity shift too, in terms of your emphasis on where the ball goes and so forth. But that was, again, a really powerful learning experience to just what you emphasize, what you spend your time on, what you care about. That's usually what ends up showing up on the floor.
Maybe just quickly go into conditioning a little bit, because I'm also imagining, knowing how you practiced, that was a big part of your practice, was just playing basketball, was conditioning to a certain extent. And some players aren't used to those type of practices either, so it's sometimes an affront to their senses as well. So talk to us about that, because when you say conditioning, I think a lot of coaches just think, oh, you're lining them up and running them like track athletes, but it's not.
No, not at all. When I was a video coordinator in breakdown practice, you'd be able to see at the end of practice how much of a 2, 2.5 hour practice, sometimes even a 3 hour practice, was actually live action and doing something that translated into the game versus how much of it was a coach talking. I'll never forget, we had a 2.5 hour practice, and I'm going through the film, and literally 27 minutes of the practice was actually practice. And that's how much teaching took place. That's how much the coaches were talking. And I've always thought a lot of teams come out of the gate out of shape, even though they're doing all this conditioning, but a lot of it is just an attribute to how much coaches are talking during practice and how much they're teaching. So, beginning of the year, we wanted to play as much as possible. And part of it was an evaluation piece. Part of it was trying to establish chemistry. And, like I said, figure out where all the pieces fit within the academy and so forth. But the value of playing and requiring the players to play at a very high standard and not stopping the play every single time there was a mistake, letting guys play through their mistakes, helped us really make sure the conditioning piece was where it needed to be. And yeah, benefit of depth and the benefit of nine guys was when you go in the game, you need to play as hard as possible because there's another guy that's sitting on the bench ready to go in. So we made conditioning a big part and a big emphasis of probably what resulted in early season success for us. Sounds good.
I know another piece I want to talk about, career management. It's not always easy. It's not always your choice. Sometimes you involuntarily leave positions, and sometimes you voluntarily leave positions because you get a better position or you get something else at a different school. But then sometimes you have these situations where you have to figure out what's best for you. And sometimes you don't stay, even though you have a job, you know it's not the right fit for you. So can you talk about managing your career in all these different ways? Because you've experienced it all.
Yeah, there is no blueprint for this profession. I can give a little plug back to Rising Coaches. That was a big part of the reason why myself, Adam Gordon, and Andy Farrell started Rising Coaches several years ago, was to help young coaches navigate the process a little bit. And I can't say that every decision I made was perfect. I think you have to make the decision that's best for you and with the information that you had. I think on the outside, there'd be a lot of questions as to some of the decisions that I made, especially leaving professional basketball for a high school job. But one, I've been, and I think the Phoenix Suns, my experience with the Phoenix Suns and really the NBA made me look at the profession this way. Everybody talks about what's your 5-year plan or when are you trying to be a head coach? They look to the future. And I think I saw so much staff change and so much different movement at the NBA level that it was completely out of my control that I started really going year by year. We talk about not riding wave of emotions in this profession. Part of a team that wins 50 games in the NBA, and then sometimes you're part of a team that wins 17 games in the NBA, and it can feel catastrophic sometimes. And so, as much as you want to ride the wave of emotion, you had to really learn how to just go day by day. And I really challenged myself to just go kind of year by year and not get too caught up in what's across my chest or the opportunities that I, would like to have, but really what's best for me in my development. And then who do I want to surround myself by every single day? Part of the reason I took this job is I knew I was going to be surrounded by really good people here. And I think, again, a lot of success goes to being surrounded by good, smart, and talented people. And we had that here. And then it was going to be a enough of a pressure situation to walk into at Bella Vista, becoming a head coach, but not so much pressure that if I made a mistake, you had 1,000 people on Twitter talking about it the next day too. A lot of times I made a mistake and I was the only one in the gym that knew they had made a mistake. So that was good for me. And I got to challenge myself and push myself that way. So a lot of times when people call and ask for advice and in terms of how they're trying to navigate their careers, they're always looking for the bigger job, higher league, more money. And you know what? Sometimes there's parts of your career where sometimes the bigger job or the more money is the most important thing. But I think especially early on in your career, you want to take opportunities for development and take opportunities for building out your coaching tree. A lot of the coaches I've worked for have retired. Sometimes that makes it a little challenging, but I have a coaching tree to go back to and people to lean on for job opportunities. So that's part of the reason why I've ended up in some of the places that I have. Somebody gave me really great advice when I was working for the Suns in terms of how much movement we had on our staff. A lot of times, and this is something that again doesn't get talked about very much, is when you see potential with coaches getting fired or potential to move up, people will stab each other in the back a little bit and they'll try to take advantage of it and they'll try to be the loudest person in the room. And the advice I was given was don't be that person. Build strong relationships with everybody because the staff will get fired. Everybody gets fired in the NBA. Everybody gets fired over the course of their career at some point or another. They're all going to land somewhere. And there's 30 jobs. So I kind of look at the NBA as you work for the NBA, maybe even more so than you do for a specific team or a specific organization or a specific person. So treat everybody with respect, be professional, learn, grow, do things the right way, because before you know it, you're going to know somebody with every single organization in the NBA. And it was really sound advice, really good advice that I got. And so again, I've really just tried to take everything year by year and what exactly I want to be doing that year and what's maybe most valuable for me at that time in my career.
I've been around you a lot of your career. And again, we all have ups and downs, but you've never been bitter. You've just always focused on getting better. And I'm so proud of all the steps that you've taken in your career. And it's been enjoyable to watch you the whole way. And Brandon, we're fortunate because we had a chance for you to share with us now. And thank you so much for sharing with us.
No, I appreciate it, Chris, and thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for all that you're doing for basketball. And obviously, you're in the grassroots space and spending a lot of time there, making a huge impact. And it's actually strengthened some of my relationships with coaches in the grassroots space because now we have a common friend, and guys will talk about their different experiences they've had working with you and how it's translated to practice and games and improving their coaching. And you're obviously doing the Zooms with EYBL and great opportunity for coaches to jump on and learn and grow. And what's tough is when you get into the season, you're so focused on yourself, you're focused on your team. And sometimes you need, whether it's these Zooms, whether it's a coaches group, to help you look outside of what's just going on internally. The thing I'll say, I'll add this thing that I love and I miss all the time about the NBA is you do have so many special coaching minds in a room together. And your job is to talk about basketball and think about basketball. And so you can go down so many different rabbit holes. So it's like there wasn't ever a day, there was never a game that I watched where I didn't learn something new. Sometimes with the smaller staffs and the more responsibility you have, you need to find outside resources and people that you can talk basketball with and think the game with. And you're obviously one of those resources for me and for a lot of coaches. Sincerely appreciate that.
Thank you. And it's been a joy to share with you and everyone else in the space. And can't wait to continue our journeys together. So thank you again for sharing the game, Brandon.